Welcome back to our podcast, Explain It Like I'm AI, Decoding AI Without Panic, Beyond Hype. In this space, we explore how artificial intelligence is transforming our world, from the way we work and communicate to how we think, learn, and create. Our goal is to move beyond fear and blind optimism, offering a balanced perspective that highlights both promises and risks of these technologies. Each episode takes a closer look at a key dimension of AI, helping you build a clear and critical understanding of how it works and what it means for society today.
Hello everyone, welcome to the fourth episode of Explain It Like I Am AI, Decoding AI Without Panic and Beyond Hype. This is a podcast of the Collegio Superiore of the University of Bologna, where we try to critically investigate the influence of artificial intelligence in various domains of life. I am Gayatri Santosh, PhD student in astrophysics at the University of Bologna and the Institute of Radio Astronomy in Bologna, and a member of the third cycle of studies in the Collegio.
And I am Lorenzo Luccioli. I'm also a PhD student in mathematics. I study AI related to the formalization of mathematics, and I'm also a student in the Collegio Superiore.
It is well known that AI is now playing a major role in scientific research. Recall that the 2024 Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to the scientists who developed AlphaFold, an AI system that predicts protein structures. Knowing the structure of these proteins is essential to understand how they interact with other molecules in our body, which is absolutely essential to develop drugs for various medical conditions. Researchers also use AI nowadays to monitor the climate and even to discover new materials. However, there are some concerns: unforeseen biases, reliance on black box models, and most concerning of all, is AI taking our jobs? In this episode, we will try to explore the emerging interconnection between AI and science through the lens of astrophysics, the study of celestial objects like stars, planets, and galaxies. We will look at some interesting science cases where AI was helpful and address some of the issues it raises. So, without further ado, let's welcome today's guest, Dr. Chiara Stuardi. She is a fixed-term researcher at the Institute of Radio Astronomy in Bologna and an expert in the field of radio astronomy, which is the study of the universe using radio signals. So, welcome, Chiara, and we are glad that we are able to have this conversation with you.
Hi, thank you. I'm also happy to be here with you.
So, to start with, we are very interested to know about your journey as a researcher and your general research area. So maybe can you tell us a few words about how you realized radio astronomy was your calling and where your research stands at this point?
Yeah. As you already said, I am a researcher at the Radio Astronomy Institute here in Bologna. I came in Bologna for my PhD before I studied physics in Turin. And I came to know about radio astronomy only at the end of my master's thesis because my professor showed me some beautiful pictures of radio galaxies that are galaxies that emit in the radio band. And they are so beautiful that I would like to study more, so know more about them. And then I came to Bologna and I discovered that also galaxy clusters that are ensemble of radio galaxies also emit radio emission. And there are these gigantic structures of radio emission that we can use to study magnetic fields. And so I was fascinated by this, basically. So I started to study that during the PhD. The focus of my study was the study of magnetic field, because this radio emission is due to the presence of magnetic fields on these large-scale structures. So through the observation of radio emission, we can understand something about the magnetic field. After the PhD, I did 2 years of research again at the University of Bologna. And then in the last 2 years, I'm in the Radio Astronomy Institute, also focusing on machine learning application to radio astronomy.
So we noticed that you started applying machine learning to your science cases very recently. So in 2024, you had a paper where you discussed an algorithm called Radio Unit, which you were using to extract the faintest sources from radio telescope images. So this can be the filamentary structures that which are found at the largest scales of the universe, or they can be the emissions from radio halos, which are large, enormous clouds of gas and energy that are from the merging of galaxies. So we are curious, how do you train the algorithm to identify these faint structures? And also, how is it better to have the algorithm instead of having a human expert looking at those images for the structures?
Yeah. As you said, I started just in the last 2 years. And this is because in the last year, there was a huge effort also in the Radio Astronomy Institute, but also in general in the scientific Italian community to use machine learning tool for the scientific analysis. And for radio astronomy, this is particularly interesting because in the last years, we start to have very huge data sets. Enormous data set that were not available like 5 years ago. And we now have them. So we have this large observation of the whole sky with millions and millions of objects. And we are interested in a particular kind of object. As you said, for example, these radio halos that are very diffuse, extended object on physical scale, but they can be also small because they are very far away. They can have different structures. It is not easy to detect them also by visual inspection. There was a work, a paper published 3 years ago that was building a catalog of these radio halos, for example, and they did visual classification of these structures, but they did it for 300 objects. And it was quite a long work already because it was involving different people looking at the same object and then deciding what was it to classify that. But now we have thousand of this kind of system. So we cannot go one by one and detect them and classify them by eye. So basically we cannot do that. So this is why machine learning is so interesting, because basically this is based on images, and just now we have this large data set of images of this large amount of sources. So just now we can apply this kind of algorithm. So in our case, so I said it is not sufficient visual inspection. Yeah, this is the reason why. So it is too large. The data set is too large. So we need to develop new algorithms. Yeah. Now we have a lot of systems, but these are still unknown systems. So we cannot train the network on just these 300 clusters, for example, that we had visually classified before. So in our case, we decided to go through simulation just as our first trial, let's say. So train our network on simulation of these clusters, galaxy cluster and large-scale structures that have simulated radio emission. So the network is already trained to recognize these kind of structures, and then we apply the same network to real data. So in this first work, we would like to see how the network was able to, let's say, change the domain, so be applying on new data set with respect to the simulation, and it worked pretty well. So this is a generally common characteristic of neural network, that they can be applied to diverse data set, and sometimes they can work very well. And in some cases, you can also fine-tune them, so retrain them on your specific data set and get better results, basically.
So this UNET architecture that you used in this work, I will try to very briefly explain like how it works to our audience. So this is a classic model of machine learning. In particular, it's a convolutional neural network, right? Where you basically take an image and you process it through mathematical operations called convolutions. This specific architecture is called a UNET because it's usually represented with the shape of the letter U. In fact, the first part of the network takes the image and usually shrinks it down through these convolutions to a smaller size. Then the second part of the network takes these smaller images and brings them back up to the previous size, and in doing so, the network compresses the information, and compressing information is a very widely used practice in machine learning because we hope that the network in this way arrives at the true features and takes out the noise from, for example, the image, but it can be useful for other kinds of data. So we were wondering, did you already know this kind of architecture before, and did you happen to identify a problem that where you could use your previous knowledge, or do you start with the problem and then go look for a specific architecture that solves that problem well?
The first one. So, yeah, I mean, not me in particular, but a collaborator of me that proposed me this kind of work. I already knew this network because he used that for a different kind of problem, for fluid dynamics, so a different kind of problem, but he already used that. So he basically started to build the network. And then since we had this simulation from another colleague, so it's really a collaborative work, we said, let's try to train the same network, but on simulation, and let's see how it worked. And then we added the noise, and so we saw how the network behaved with the noise. And then when I started, we decided to try to apply it to this data. So this was the workflow. So we had this network, it was working well, and we tried to apply to new data.
So the considerations were mostly driven by the fact that someone already knew in your team the architecture, and that you had like data available to train it from some other project, right?
Yeah.
And do you also take into consideration other aspects, like, for example, performance or the cost of running the architecture?
Well, yeah, a bit. I must say, we also tried another network, a similar network with transformers, for example, that is a kind of more complex architecture that is specific for images, let's say, but I will not go into detail. So we tested these other architectures, and for example, we compared the two architectures also in terms of computational cost. But in our case, we were running on Cineca, that is a supercomputing center here in Bologna, and we don't have problem of computing time. We did not investigate this more than that, but we compared, for example, these two networks and compare also the expenses in the two cases. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And another aspect that is sometimes used to choose different architectures is that of explainability. So explainability means when I can see what the network is doing inside, so when I can explain why the network, for example, chose to classify an object as a certain type of star. And it's something that certain architectures give because they take some paths that can be explained by human, but other kinds of architecture do not give this ability, and we call them black boxes. UNETs and also transformers that you mentioned are usually considered such black boxes because you cannot really understand what the model is doing inside, because it's just doing mathematical operations that do not correspond to features that we as humans can like name or distinguish very well. So another work that we noticed is not one of your works, but it's a work from some American scientists that discovered some exoplanets, so some planets that are outside the solar system, and they managed to find them using an architecture that was also explainable. Now, the way they did it in this case was to identify some features that human experts use to actually identify exoplanets, and then explicitly feed those features to a neural network, which could then use them to choose whether something was an exoplanet or not. And then afterwards, the scientists could see which features were used mostly to make that decision. And so I was wondering, is explainability something that you take into consideration during your work? Or are you mostly concerned about performance or like accuracy or other metrics?
Yeah, at the moment, I would say we are not really interested in that, just because we are really at the beginning of using this kind of methodology for this kind of classification and detection of object. And I would also say that our classification is still not perfectly clear. So there are many objects, for example, Gayatri told about radio halo, but there are also other objects that are radio relics, mini halo, and sometimes the class really merge one to the other. So at the moment, we were not really interested in the classification, but just in the detection. So this was just one point. So we were not really interested for this specific task of the classification. Yeah, you're right. I mean, UNET and also transformers are considered as black boxes. In our case, our way to validate them was to compare with, as I said, we were training on simulation, so we had the ground truth of our simulation because we already knew what was real emission, what was noise. So in our case, we compare and we, as you said, we use, for example, the accuracy or other metrics to validate our networks. And then when we compare with the real observation, we already have this sample of clusters that were already detected and classified. So also in that case, basically, we were verifying the accuracy of the network compared with a ground truth, let's say, in that case. But of course, yes, this is something that we can consider for future works. And this is for sure something interesting. I saw this kind of work in many other fields of astrophysics, so it's really something that is start to be used for classification. In particular, now we are in the position where we can validate by eye now, but in the future we want to have more really automated pipe that we don't have to double check basically what the machine learning is doing, or otherwise it's not useful anymore. So yeah, it's important.
As a final follow-up to this particular topic, so is there any limit to the brightness of the sources that the AI can identify or think?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what we saw is that we can go beyond the limit of, let's say, standard thresholding method, so just measuring the noise of an image. You can understand what you can detect and what you can't. But for example, using this convolution neural network, we detected sources really at the boundary of the noise. Of course, you cannot go farther below. You cannot, you still have your data. You cannot find something that is not in your data, yeah.
Yeah. So now we will move away from your work and we want to focus on some other interesting applications in astronomy where AI has been used. So one such application is in the identification of variable stars, which are stars whose brightness will change significantly with time, as opposed to, let's say, our sun, which has a constant brightness all the time. So in the spring of this year, there was an article that detailed how AI was used to identify 1.5 million variable stars. To give an idea of the amount of data that was involved, it seemed that of the survey of all the sources, each object had about 200 billion points of brightness data that varied with time that had to be analyzed to detect which all sources are undergoing significant changes in their brightness. This is something that a human being will not be able to do in a reasonable amount of time. And Lorenzo will explain the technique that they used, and then let's go ahead with the questions.
So yes, they basically took this data, which are time series of brightness, and first they extracted the Fourier coefficients. So Fourier analysis is a very well-known tool in mathematics, where you analyze some data to try and take out the periodic parts with different periods. So with these light sources, we know that periodicness is a very important part because we want to analyze things that happen periodically, but we do not know how often they happen. So what they do is, instead of feeding the raw data to a neural network, they feed these Fourier coefficients. And then again, they use a CNN, so a convolutional neural network. Not a UNet, but still the same family of machine learning algorithm that we mentioned before. Before, we mentioned that this algorithm can be used for images, but in this case, we have one-dimensional data where our dimension is time, but still CNNs can be used with good performance in the same way. So we were wondering, is this a kind of technique where you put together mathematical processing of data and then some more machine learning style algorithm standard in your field? Are CNNs like the standard in your field, or are there other like very well known and often used machine learning techniques?
I would say that in our field, since we mostly work on images, I would say that CNN are still, starting from the images is the mostly used, the mostly used category of network that are used. Of course, for example, for variability or also for chemical abundances, for example, there are also some one-dimensional data set that are spectra, for example. So at different frequencies, you have different intensity of emission. So in that case, you are interested in particular features in the one-dimensional spectrum. So in that case, maybe you can use different kind of algorithms. But yeah, I think that nowadays astronomy and radio astronomy also is exploring all different kind of structures. But I would say that convolutional neural network are for sure the first in the list. Yeah.
And so all these algorithms that we mentioned until now, they are mostly classification algorithms. So algorithms that allow us to detect something or to classify something to say if it's in one category or in another one. But we know that now, in the last 3-4 years, the real star of AI have been the generative algorithms, starting from the transformers to produce text, but also diffusion models to produce images. And we're seeing them every day now. They can even produce videos, for example. So do you ever happen to use generative algorithms in your work, or do you plan to use them in the future?
Well, I saw some generative work, for example, diffusion model are also used, for example, also for creating new, let's say, mock observations, so simulated observation of the sky. They are also used to create a larger data set to train the network. For example, there was a work, again, using convolutional neural network, but I mean, using also data augmentation in order to have a larger data set for training. And then there are also, for example, the use of large language models that is also emerging also, for example, that can put together text and images, for example, and perform classification, but with different, also using the text, for example. Or these are also used, for example, for archival research, where instead of inserting a simple string or simple number to search some interesting object in the archives. For example, there are some development in using large language model also for archival research, also in astronomy. So there is a big exploration of different kind of methodologies.
Okay, so now back to the article we mentioned before. I think there was an interesting detail about it, right?
Yes. So one of the most remarkable aspects about the article about variable stars that I mentioned is that the developer of this algorithm is actually a high school student. This person, he was working on a short-term project with a professor when he came across this data, and then he decided he did not want to work on it by hand and therefore went ahead and made the algorithm. So it made us curious. So AI, is it making the field of astrophysics or science in general more access to the public? Or on the flip side, is it possible that as AI is becoming more and more applied in science, it will be very disadvantageous to the researchers who are not that well-versed in, let's say, the artificial intelligence or programming in general? What is your opinion?
Well, I think that machine learning is a tool like many other tools that we can use. So I would not say that it's more difficult or less difficult to approach than other fields. I mean, it has its own language, its own specific characteristics, but still, yeah, I think that it's something that it should be considered as a tool, as other that we already have. For example, when I came to know about this paper, yeah, I mean, I would not be able to write machine learning, I mean, architecture when I was 18 years old, but neither to program in Python. So, for example, for me, it was very surprising, of course, to know about that. But yeah, I think that there are several artificial intelligence tools that are now can help also people to learn and to write their own code. But of course, normal path of people is that, of course, they have to study the basics of all these architectures and all of these tools, because you have to understand them before using them. This is common practice for science. And with, I mean, it's the same for machine learning and for other statistics tool, I would say.
So one thing which is very interesting nowadays is the usage of AI in publications. So what is your opinion on creating entire texts out of AI? Like, where do you think we should draw the line?
Yeah, this is a difficult question. I mean, AI is very useful for writing. You cannot use AI as an input. You have to give your input to AI and then let it to probably modify and adjust it. But it's always a recursive process. You cannot let it do. I mean, the same for science. You have always to check your results. And the same is for using AI for writing, for everything. So I think it's very useful. Where to stop? Well, I think that everyone has to understand where to stop. But for example, in science, there are always some freedom to, for example, to invent your data somehow. And you know where to stop. I mean, where you lie, you have to stop. But of course, it's more difficult now with machine learning to understand where you have to stop. But I must say that probably anyone should understand where. However, I think it's very useful. I mean, that we have to use it, and because we have this kind of tool, and it's very useful also for general purpose. What I'm afraid of is sometimes I feel that it can be dangerous for learning, as I said before, because when you use it, you tend to skip some steps that normally when you study, you have to start from the beginning and to learn by yourself, while with machine learning and with the AI, sometimes you tend to skip the first step and go directly to the end, basically. So you skip the process. And this, I think, it can be dangerous because you don't learn anymore. And this is also more difficult to understand where to stop. But we should cope with that. So we also should learn how to interact with the artificial intelligence, I would say.
So you seem quite enthusiastic about these tools, but not everyone is like this. So there's people who are more skeptical about using those tools, both in personal life, but especially in research or in domains where it's somehow like the result is important, sensitive. So do you face any sort of such skepticism during your work in your research group, or maybe when you say your result to others, when you communicate your results?
Yeah, there is still some skepticism about the use of artificial intelligence in science, I would say. As I said, we as a scientist, we should consider it as a tool, as others. And when we speak about artificial intelligence, like the new truth or the new gods, I don't know, but that's the problem when we think that it will solve all the problems. And so I think that this make people to have skepticism about artificial intelligence, because of course it will not solve all the problems that we have in science. It will not discover anything totally new. I mean, we still need to put our brain. I face this, but I think that going on and starting to use it as a normal tool for science, I think it will move away. So we will be able to use it, to trust it when we can trust it. And I mean, I think it will go away. Yeah.
So have there been cases where you obtained some result and then you were like, what? Where you had to double check
For example, using this network, for example, there was a particular galaxy cluster where we already know that was a central radio halo, so this large radio emission covering the central part of the cluster. But when we applied this UNET, so this tool, we discover the UNET found that the emission was larger than was previously known, for example. And the shape was also particularly strange. Not a circular shape, as is it normal, but more elongated. And so we went there and investigated more. So from the image, you could not spot the presence of this emission. But then with the UNET, we discovered this new emission. And then we were more surprised when we compare our findings, so basically the radio emission, the extent of the radio emission, with other wavelengths. So we discovered that were two more galaxy clusters near the center one, basically. So there was physically something more that was not visible before. And yeah, this was surprising for me.
So we can see that AI enables to make actual real discoveries that were not possible before. But we mentioned at the start of the episode AlphaFold, in chemistry in particular, in the discovery of the structure of proteins. Now, in that particular case, it seems like AI was not only able to make new science, but it was able to do a really huge breakthrough that completely revolutionized a whole area of research. So do you think such big and revolutionary breakthroughs are possible in the near future in other fields, for example, yours or some other physical fields?
Well, I think that, as I said, we are starting now a new era for radio astronomy with this totally new surveys. For example, there will be a new survey that will observe the full southern sky, and that will start at the end of 2030. And this will open up a new discovery window for sure. We should have the tool to analyze that amount of data. So in that case, I would say that machine learning will for sure be a strong component of this new discovery that will come, that I don't know, but maybe new kind of sources. For sure, many more objects that we know now, so that maybe we can create bigger catalog to compute more statistics also on the known object. And yeah, so I would say that it would be a breakthrough also in our science. Yeah, the problem of the machine learning trying to substitute ourselves as a scientist. I mean, this is a problem that came every time a new tool is discovered. For example, when I started the PhD already, there were some scientists that some radio astronomers that were processing all the data by hand, basically, from the telescope up to the images. And this is a really long process. I will not go into detail, but there are a lot of steps that you have to do, from acquiring data and then processing them, calibrating them, and then making images. But nowadays, this is not doing, I mean, it's not done anymore. This is done by pipeline, and this is an automatic process. People that were used to do it by hand, of course, are complaining because they like to do this like that. And I can understand perfectly. But things move on. And I think that every time that a new discovery and a new tool come, we should adapt ourselves to do new kind of science and new, I mean, we can occupy ourselves in doing something else. So again, it's just a matter of changing the way we are doing science, not that we are not usable anymore. Yeah, that's...
Thank you. So you, just to conclude, you actually mentioned more than once how AI should be a tool in the hands of scientists, but someone is trying to develop systems that are not just tools, but are autonomous systems that completely replace parts of the work of programmers, for example, of writers, of artists, and now even of scientists in some case. So do you think that's actually a possibility in the near future? Do you think we will witness a time where the job of a scientist can be done completely autonomously by an AI system, for example?
No, completely autonomously, I don't think so. Maybe we should change somehow our work, do something different as before. But I would say human beings should be for sure present in the discovery, in the scientific path. Yeah, I would say that it's not possible to substitute all of us, of course, but we have to change the way in which we use these tools and we make science, I think. Yeah.
Yes. So that brings us to the conclusion of this episode. So based on the discussion, what we can understand is that AI has to be used as a tool. And in that sense, it greatly reduces the time needed for research, and it will be very helpful in data intensive cases. And like you mentioned, it's definitely not advisable to rely on black box models. It is important to bring up explainability, and also it is important to validate the results in the end using some physical results and so on. And then you mentioned that the fear of AI taking over the jobs is actually a very real thing nowadays. And so as you say, as human beings, we still have some, I mean, we should be there to make sense of the results. And so it seems that AI cannot take over us, that will be something very assuring to, let's say, the general public. Yeah, I think that ends our episode. So thank you, Chiara, for being here. It was great talking to you. I'd also like to thank Collegio for this opportunity of recording the episode, and Kine for the recording studio and all the equipment, and Thanks. Thank you so much.
Thank you.